Well, Bob Parrish represented my husband in a lawsuit which arose out of his first wife's death. It was Scheibel versus the Lathrop Company and the city of Fairbanks. And this was the case. Well, the first it went up on a petition, and I think it was the first petition that was ever granted under the state Supreme Court.
State Supreme Court. Uh-huh. This was after state law.
Yes. Uh huh. Yeah. And it went up on a petition for review. Parrish raised. Well, the city of Fairbanks had raised the question of immunity, mm-hmm. municipal immunity, and Parrish took it up, and they sent it back down for trial. And that, I think that it was the territorial, the U.S. District Court that had said, yes, there was municipal immunity in the state, in the territory. And then right after that came the Supreme Court. This was before the Superior Court was in existence. And it went up, and one of the early opinions that came down was the Scheibel opinion. And of course, all during this time, I got to know Bob Parrish fairly well, because I was, my husband and I were married. And
what did you think of Bob Parrish?
Oh, I, of all the members of the bar that I have known and not practiced with, he was probably one that I admired the most. Just really a very tenacious lawyer, very bright, a real pioneer. I don't know, you know, what the personal injury lawyers were like in the other parts of the state, but Bob was, you know, Mr. Personal Injury in Fairbanks. And I think of all the lawyers in the field in the state, he was probably the most innovative. Had really good ideas, good instincts. As long as his wife was alive, she did a tremendous amount of research for him. Bob was always able to get bright young people to work with him. And, you know, he knew how to make them plow. And,
who were some of the people who worked
with
him?
Well, Blair, Millard Ingram, Judge Blair. Millard Ingram, well, those are the ones I think I remember the most, because both of them had worked with Bob. But Virginia Parrish herself was a very bright lady, and she'd gone, I think, maybe 1, maybe 2 years to law school, and then had had quit law school probably when Nelson was born. And I knew about the Parrishes even before I knew them, because they had gone to law school in West Virginia at the same time as friends of mine had been in graduate school in West Virginia. They were people connected with, they were geophysicists, and they were connected with the university, Geophysical Institute, and I knew them.
Were both the Parrishes in law school at the same time?
I think so. Mm-hmm. And they were there at the same time as Bill Moran from Anchorage, the Chugach Electric lawyer. And of course, I knew Bill Moran when he first came to Alaska, because he came with the Legislative Investigating Committee, which was right next door to the Legislative Council. So I've known Bill Moran for more than 30 years.
So he started out in Juneau?
Bill Moran did, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was with the Legislative Investigating Committee.
Was he friendly with the Parrishes too? Was he?
Well, they would all been in law school together, mm-hmm. In West Virginia. And then, of course, Bill had been overseas and was rather late in coming back because he'd been with the military government in Bavaria, where he met his wife. And they were all friends with the Murdys, too. The Morans and the Murdys, because they lived in the same general area in Juneau. So,
when you first came to Fairbanks, who are considered the great old statesmen of the bar, the great lawyers in the bar?
Well, Julian Hurley, probably. I never considered him the great old statesman, but a lot of attorneys did.
Why?
Why didn't I consider him?
Why
didn't I? Well, I just thought he was sort of a has-been.
Why?
I don't know. I think maybe he was a drunken has-been in my mind. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But Julian Hurley was a person I had no great deal of admiration for. Mm-hmm. Ralph wouldn't have been practicing. He would have been off to Washington. See, the years that I was in Washington, I got to know Ralph Rivers fairly well because he was one of the Tennessee planners with Greening and Egan. And I used to meet with him at the Bartletts all the time because the Bartletts were all close friends from my childhood days in Juneau. Mm-hmm. But
what did you think of Ralph Rivers?
Oh, I liked Ralph. Never really thought about him as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
It was more political to me than a lawyer, more politician than a lawyer. I never thought about him as much as a lawyer. But E.B. Collins. Mike Stepovich. Of course, the one I admired a great deal was Bill Boggess. I met him, I think in the summer of '58, and one of my professors at law school had been dean of Indiana when he had been a student there. He never thought much of Fowler Harper, and I did, but. Other than that disagreement, I had a great deal of respect for Bill Boggess. Mm-hmm. And George McNabb was also from Indiana, but I wouldn't say that he was one of the deans. It was probably E.B. Collins, Chuck Clasby. And I think Collins retired right about that time. My memory gets dim.
So were you all starting up a new practice when you came, the Murdys Camero?
Well, that Bob McNeely, of course, had been practicing here for a number of years. Ed Murdys joined him in 1957. Mm-hmm. And Henry Camero joined him in 1959. And I had joined them in 1959.
So you don't know how much the community helped by referring cases and that sort of thing?
No.
There was nothing when you were here. No. Friendly.
Passing things along?
Yes, passing things along.
Oh, there. I'm sure there was quite a bit of it. But, of course, there's a law clerk and then the youngest associate and a woman I just didn't know, But I do know that the old-time practitioners had their ups and downs as far as their friendly relationship. There was a tremendous amount of courtesy in the bar, some of which still exists. But certainly not to the degree that it existed before. Mm-hmm. Charlie Cole was practicing then. I'd have to sit down and really think about the old-time practitioners that were... Oh, you have a list. Mary Alice Miller, of course, was with Collins and Clasby. Warren Taylor. Oh, was E.P. McCarran still around? My God. Yeah, I know he had to be. Peggy was here.
What did E.P. McCarran do? What kind of...
I don't really know. I didn't know him very well. I knew his wife. Oh, Gene Miller. My God, I forgot about him. I never really knew him in those days, though. Sherman Noyes. Oh, Morris Johnson. Now, Morris Johnson was disciplined, it seems to me.
For what?
Can't remember. It seems to me he made off with... Maybe they cleared it up. But he was about to be disciplined. Mm-hmm. Involvement with his clients' trust funds. Charles, George Yeager, Ralph Rivers, Walter Scudlow, Julian Herman, Ted wasn't practicing. I was here. Oh, Vernon Forbes. Yeah. He was on the bench.
What do you think of Vernon Forbes?
Oh, Fanny Pincher. Excuse me. I didn't care much for Vernon Forbes.
Why not?
Well, I... Sexist. No, really. I guess he considered me fair game, an old woman, and younger, quite a bit younger than her husband, and I don't know. I just never got along with Vernon Forbes.
Did he make comments to you in court? No.
I would never appeared before him in court.
On the street?
No, in social affairs. Social affairs. Oh my God, Harry Pratt. I remember him. Sometime during college, I was in Harry Pratt's courtroom, and I can't remember why, but I was there, and I saw Judge Pratt on the bench. I knew his wife slightly, and I knew his two daughters, mm-hmm. Octavia and I can't remember the younger daughter's name, but I just knew them slightly, and I remember seeing him, a very imposing man who used to sleep on the bench. Walter Hodge, yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that he was really here that much.
I think just real briefly before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, was he first one of
Because I don't know why I always think of him as Nome.
Because he'd been judge up there for a long
time. Yeah, okay, yeah. There was somebody else. Oh, Keogh.
Was that at Mill?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and I just his name just came up the other day. I was the House of Wood making arrangements to have some things framed, and Donna Wood was very gingerly taking off a Keogh watercolor that had been glued to the backing. Clegg. My God, I haven't heard that name. They don't
have.
Oh yeah, but not in a long time. Yeah. T.N. Gore, Everett Hepp, Julian Rice.
And then the big company.
Yeah. There are a couple of people that there is one of the old time attorneys whose nephew still lives in Fairbanks. I think it's his nephew, he is the assistant director of finance for the city now. Rogers. I can't think of his first name at the moment. I've just got real aphasia. But his uncle was Charles Taylor, one of the old time attorneys in Fairbanks.
Yes,
Luther Hess. Luther Hess, mm-hmm. One of the old-time attorneys around here.
Well, there's just no record of these people.
Oh,
well. Charles Taylor.
Yeah, Charles Taylor and Luther Hess. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Bunnell had a real problem as he got older, and though, when he developed diabetes in the late 40s and in the early 50s, he could never keep me straight. You know, to him it seemed like I'd been around forever. And so he'd always be talking about, well, you know, remember when Harry Pratt did this? Or do you remember when John somebody did this? And, you know, he was talking about Judge Pratt, whom, you know, I scarcely knew, and he was talking about somebody who graduated in the class of 1930. And he had a very difficult time placing me in time.
Mm-hmm. What was he himself like, Bunnell?
Dr. Bunnell? He was one of the sweetest men in the world. I'm sure that his wife couldn't live with him because he was impossible to live with. But
why was he impossible to live with?
Oh, he had quirks. You know, just, you know, he'd get very angry about something, and then, you know, he'd just be, you know, couldn't understand why you'd get upset because he'd gotten so angry at you. But he was a marvelous president of the university. I'm sure he was a very fine lawyer. Very analytical, everything he did. But, it, you know, he's a person I was so close to at a very important time in my life. I have a hard time being objective about him. I have all the letters that he ever wrote me, and it's a very large box, because we were good friends. When I first came to the university, I had met him, you know, as the secretary of the superintendent of schools. And when I first came to the university, he demanded to know why I was late. He, you know, he was expecting me on a certain day, and I didn't arrive on that certain day. The campus was very small. There were 125 students. And he had told the dean of the university that I was going to be his secretary. And I had no intention of working. But he said, oh, yes, you know. And we had a long argument about that. And he said, well, you go tell Dean Duckering that you're not going to work for him. And so I went to tell Dean Duckering I wasn't going to work for him, and he persuaded me that I really should. So I did. And then all during the time that I was there, I went to church every Sunday, take the bus into town, and Dr. Bunnell got used to the idea that I was going into town and that he could come over after breakfast and get me to type this little short letter that he needed to go in the mail that day. And I could, you know, type the letter, and then I could take it into town. And over the years, we just, you know, became very good friends. It was a small, friendly campus. And then after I left the university, we kept up a voluminous correspondence. And he would visit me in Washington, D.C., or I would come back on the campus and visit him in the summers. And, there were times when he would just insist that I come back up. He wasn't well enough to travel, and that I'd have to come back up to visit him, and I would. Mm-hmm. He was a very lonely man. He and his daughter never hit it off 100%, and I was sort of like a substitute daughter. But again, he just confused me in time. And it was that I had known everybody that had ever been on the campus of the university. And that, you know, when I was in law school, which was right before he died, that I just, you know, I really knew all the lawyers. Mm-hmm. When I was doing my legislative research work, I had to ask him a few odd questions that hard sometimes to get answers. But he was a man, as the president of the university, he followed the legislative scene very closely, and he knew a lot of the personalities. And so I'd have to write and ask him for help, and he'd always respond. He'd either phone me or write me. I need to know. But we just remained very good friends. And I understood all of his feuds and his difficulties, and I tended to side with him more than I did with his adversaries in the process. Well, James Wickersham was one. Mm-hmm. And it was the they had been political adversaries, and I think that Bunnell was capable of getting over it, but that he really didn't want to because he didn't think Wickersham wanted to. I think his greatest adversary were some of the congressmen from the Midwest who felt that he was too political a person to be the president of a land-grant college. And we suffered through some of those foibles. They took the agricultural experiment stations away from the university for a while, and it took us a while to get those back. Territorial legislature didn't fund the university properly, and we went through the process his last years of having to borrow money to keep the doors open. And Cap Lathrop and Andrew Nern. Cap Lathrop was on the Board of Regents, and Cap Lathrop helped supply the money to keep the university open. Andrew Nerland, Luther Hess. Harriet Hess had been on the Board of Regents from day one.
And Luther Hess was a lawyer.
Luther Hess was a lawyer.
Who else on the Board of Regents do you remember as being lawyers?
Well, Luther wasn't on the board, his wife was.
His wife.
Harriet Hess. Odie Cochran. On the board. I can't think of anyone until Brian Brundin.
Did he ever tell you about his early years as a district judge? Did he ever talk about the early court system, the early...
Yes, he talked a lot about it.
What did he say?
I don't remember.
Oh, dear.
No, it's criminal that we could never get that man to write down everything. He kept saying he was going to do it. But if people would be able to find his correspondence, because he was very meticulous in his correspondence. In fact, I was looking for something the other day, and I came across the box, and there was a visitor at the house, and so I was showing him some of Dr. Bunnell's letters, and they're fabulous letters, and great joy to read. I'm going to give them all to the university. Mm-hmm. But the only one that I really remember is a fear that he had. One of the people that... had been tried for multiple murders and had gone to McNeil Island and had escaped, and with the avowed threat of coming back to kill Dr. Bunnell, kill Judge Bunnell. We all called him Judge, incidentally, and it wasn't until I became his secretary that I started calling him Dr. Bunnell. We just referred to him as Judge. On the campus, everyone called him Judge. Are you going to see the judge today? And you met Dr. Bunnell.
Yeah.
But all the students called him the judge. And it wasn't until I became the secretary that I had to drop the judge bit and refer to him as Dr. Bunnell. But this man had the avowed threat of coming back to Alaska to kill him, and the FBI would check in on him periodically to find out that he was all right. Dr. Bunnell would never sit with his back exposed, no matter where you were. It was just a phobia that he had. And,
did they ever catch the man?
No.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Not that I know of. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the last times that we were together in a situation, in a restaurant, was in Washington, D.C. And the waitress started to seat us. And he said, no, we'll change places. And, the waitress didn't know what was going on. I knew what was going on. But
in any of the correspondence, are there things about the old court system?
No.
Nothing about
no, no,
old
it's,
lawyers? Or?
No. A lot of the correspondence was about the problems of the transition between the second and third president of the university. A lot of the correspondence is about the appointment of Ernest Greening's successor as governor of Alaska. Visit of political figures to the campus. Politics generally in the territory.
Heintzelman, 63?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was he pro-Heintzelman?
Yes.
Republican?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't that he was for Heintzelman because Heintzelman was a Republican. Heintzelman was a person that he'd known because Heintzelman headed the Department of Agriculture in Alaska because he was the head of the Forest Service, mm-hmm. and that was the main Department of Agriculture function. Mm-hmm. And Frank went to bat mm-hmm. to help the university get back the experimental stations. And so, you know, he and Frank were old friends, and he would like to see somebody of Frank's caliber in as the governor. And that's what he was basically concerned with, is to be someone of his caliber. He wasn't supporting Frank particularly, at least not that I recall. I'd have to review the correspondence, but I was in Washington at the time and, you know, spending a lot of time with the Bartletts. And of course, Frank Heintzelman was an old friend. And Frank would usually call me when he was in town, when he was in Washington, and I'd go down and have breakfast with him. It was a convenient time to meet. I used to go down and have breakfast with Frank Heintzelman and then get back to the dormitory, and there was a letter from Dr. Bunnell, because he was writing me airmail special delivery letters every day for months. But,
is there anything else that I should know about the bar?
Well, I wish I could think of people who could, you know, put you in on some of the old-time lawyers, but they're just not around anymore. Except Cliff Rogers, and he might be able to tell you some things about his uncle. Yeah, because
you know, a person you might want to talk to would be Alaska Link.
As your outline says, Vivi versus Vivi, and that was the case that concerned the guardian ad litem's right to preempt the judge. Next thing is in your outline, which is on page 10, is the other statute that I mentioned a little while ago that doesn't get as much attention as it perhaps should, and it's the action for failure to permit visitation. And when a court order is specific about visitation of a minor child and the custodial parent fails to permit that visitation to occur, the person entitled to it has a cause of action against the custodian for damages. The amount of damages is $200 for each failure to permit visitation. The problem is that a lot of divorce decrees say that the mother will have custody and the father will have generous and liberal visitation. And if you have that kind of divorce decree, this statute doesn't do you any good because it says here a court order has to be specific, so it has to be one of those ones that says every other weekend and alternate Wednesdays or something like that. There's presently a bill in the legislature to raise the amount of the fine to, I think, $300, and I don't know if this will pass, to make failure to permit visitation a Class B misdemeanor, which I think, although I'm not really up on the new criminal code, is the lowest class of misdemeanor. I don't know whether that'll pass or not. That's a fairly heavy penalty for not complying with visitation, but, you know, in certain instances it might do the trick. custody decisions are appealed. When they're appealed, the standard of review is, has there been an abuse of discretion, or are the findings of fact clearly erroneous? Which basically means that custody decisions are hard to appeal successfully unless there's really been something done by the trial judge that you can pin your appeal on. But many, many Supreme Court opinions say that they do not find there's been an abuse of discretion. They might not have done the same thing as the trial judge, but they can't say it's an abuse of discretion, so they aren't going to reverse the trial court decision. A real recent case, Matson versus Matson, I don't know how many of you have read that, January case, came down, involved a custody dispute. That's kind of an interesting case. The parents were divorced, and the child lived with his father's first cousin, and the father lived about 100 yards away. And this case was decided first by a standing master who applied Turner versus Panic, which is the case that establishes the standard for determining parental versus non-parental or grandparental custody. And under that standard, he gave custody to the mother. But he said that had he applied a best interest test, he would have also given custody to the mother. The trial judge, this was, the master's report was objected to, and the trial court said that the father was seeking custody, not the cousin, and on that basis gave custody to the father. The Supreme Court agreed with the trial judge, saying that custody is not simply a matter of physical control or proximity over a child, and they followed a best interest analysis through what the trial court had, and agreed that the father should be the custodian, even though he was always going to continue living 100 yards away, and the child was going to continue to live with his cousin. So it's kind of a strange case. Yes?
Can you explain briefly when a divorce case is heard before a special master and when it goes directly to a judge? Or what the... you keep mentioning masters.
Yeah. Do I have enough time left on this tape to do that? Yeah. A divorce case goes to a trial judge the first time it goes to trial. A lot of, especially in the last couple of years, a lot of post-divorce litigation has been heard by standing masters who are appointed by the court. I think mainly to take the burden off the trial judges, and because there is a lot of post-divorce litigation. Also, a lot of the pendente lite litigation is heard by standing masters. So it's really the trial that goes before the judge. Sometimes a special master is appointed in a divorce trial to make certain particular kinds of findings. If, for instance, the parties have a lot of property and there are a lot of accounting problems, and they need somebody to sort through that and make some findings of fact in that area. But that's not too common.
Is that done on motion, on the judge's own motion, or is it done on, the, on one of the parties' motion?
It could be either. Go on.
Just like.
Yeah. At the break, somebody came up to me and asked me if I would discuss the Matson case again. And somebody else came up and pointed out that in terms of sort of Alaskan realities, it's probably the right decision. It was a custody dispute. The mother moved to modify the father's award of custody because the father didn't actually have the child living with him. The child was living with his cousin, and father lived just down the street. I can't remember what village this was in, but it was out somewhere in western Alaska. And this was heard before the master who applied Turner versus Panic, which is the parent versus non-parent standard, and decided that as between the cousin and the mother should be preferred and the custody should be switched to her. And then the master also added in a little aside saying he would have found it in the best interest of the child to go with the mother had he applied a best interest analysis. The trial court, when this was objected and brought to the trial judge's attention, rejected the master's determination and said that the father was the actual custodian and not his cousin, and on that basis gave custody to the father. The Supreme Court agreed with the trial court, saying that custody is not just a matter of physical control over the child. It's a sort of broader concept, and following the best interest analysis, they found that it was in the best interest of the child to be in his father's custody. But it was not disputed, apparently, that the child was going to go on living with his father's cousin, but nonetheless they found that the father was the custodian. So it's probably the best for the child. This is kind of an odd case. Another January custody case is Craig versus McBride, and this involves two unmarried people. It was a custody dispute which the Supreme Court remanded because it found that the original award might have been based on what they called impermissible criteria. The trial court, which I believe was the trial court in Juneau, gave the father custody because he was more able to provide a stable environment for the child. And in doing this, it referred to the fact that the mother had three children out of wedlock and had demonstrated a lot of instability in her personal relationships. The Supreme Court said, and their words were, we cannot countenance reference to the mother's sexual conduct. And unless it could be shown to adversely affect the child or the mother's parenting abilities, it shouldn't have been considered. The Supreme Court also said that consideration should have been given to the desirability of not separating the child in question from her half-sister, who was not at issue in the action. But again, they said that they were not making a hard and fast rule about not separating the kids, but that that's an important factor. And then finally, they said, another little twist at the end of this case, they said the trial court, when it heard this again, would have to consider the effect of the child having spent the 2 years that it took for the appeal process with her father, even though this would penalize the mother, who was the prevailing party on appeal. So, have to wait to see what happens with that one. But that's another kind of interesting case, and it's a very recent one. So it's probably one you should be aware of. Okay, the next section is on child support. It's an area of great trouble and problems in domestic relations. In order for the court to make an award of child support, it has to have in pursuing jurisdiction. And child support is based on the needs of the child or the children and the ability of the parents to pay. It can be paid directly to the parents, or it can be paid through the Child Support Enforcement Agency, which is a department within the State Department of Revenue. And there is a duty, although people are surprised to find this, there is a duty to pay child support in the absence of any order or judgment. Parents just have a duty to support their children. There's a series of cases listed in your outline on page 11. The first one saying that each spouse has an obligation to support children regardless of the spouse's sex, and even though their abilities to furnish support may be unequal. A child can proceed independently for child support against his parents or guardian, and the child's creditors can also move for child support. I don't know that this happens all that often, except in cases where the state is chasing child support for the child because they've paid out welfare money. Spouses have an obligation to support each other. If one spouse can't support himself, the other one is supposed to support him or her. And Young versus Williams case is a few years old. Said that payments that are made voluntarily to children, such as gifts or wages, don't satisfy child support obligation or not be used to reduce child support obligation. That's an area that comes up quite a bit. One parent is ordered to pay child support and is very resentful about it, and so they'll say, well, I don't think I should pay this month, but I bought him a bicycle and I bought him some clothes, and so I've done my part. And the court will say, no, you did that as a volunteer. You still have to pay your $400 or $500 a month, however much child support has been set. And child support payments, each child support payment, as it accrues or becomes due as a judgment, and the statute of limitations on that is the statute of limitations for judgments in general, which is 10 years. So if you have a situation where a child is getting child support until they're 18, the last time that the mother can sue for the child support payment would be on the child's 28th birthday. When child support isn't being paid, there's sort of two avenues that people pursue. One is to hold the non-payer into court on a contempt motion, and that's not real successful because then they demand a jury trial and then you have a big mess and no money is forthcoming for the children. So the best way is to reduce the child support for marriages to judgment and execute on whatever you can find to execute on. Oftentimes it has to be the father's salary, or the mother is the one that's not paying.
Does anyone beside the custodial parent have standing to sue to enforce
payment of child support?
Payment of child support.
I don't.
On a practical basis, yes, because anyone receiving welfare or AFDC signs an assignment of their rights.
Yeah, so in that situation, yeah. I don't know of any other situations in which they can. A recent case, well, not so recent actually, it was early last year, Hinchey versus Hinchey, made it perfectly clear that the court can't award child support beyond the age of majority. In this case, they awarded it to the age of 23. This is an area of a lot of squabbling, and a lot of people maintain that the statute should be interpreted to say that child support stops at 18. Not so in Alaska. It can go on forever. Okay, going to modification of child support. In order to modify a child support decree, the person who's seeking a modification has to show either that the child's needs are less or the changed conditions in the parent's financial abilities justify reducing the burden on the parents by paying less child support. Curley versus Curley is the important case in the area of reduction of child support payments. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that a modification of a support order seeking to reduce child support can only be obtained where there's material and substantial change in circumstances of a more or less permanent rather than temporary nature. And the change of circumstances cannot have arisen out of some kind of voluntary act of the party seeking the reduction. For instance, if the father wants to have his child support reduced because he quit his job because he thought it would be nice to be a sculptor or just stay home and read books for a year. The court isn't going to be one bit sympathetic. You're not going to stay, even though your income has dropped by 75%, you still have to pay the child support that you were ordered to pay before you embarked on this new lifestyle. And as it says in your outline, the factors that the court has to take into consideration of whether the child's needs are less than they were at the time of the divorce, that's very, very unusual. They're almost always greater. About the only situation I think that would occur would be if a child had to have some kind of special treatment or special care at the time of the divorce and had grown beyond that period. Yeah?
Is inflation a grounds for going back in?
For modifying upwards, yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. To modify a child support award upwards, you also have to show a change of circumstances. Sometimes the court will attempt to hold people to the material and substantial change of circumstances, but for the most part, courts have been pretty sympathetic to motions to modify child support to increase it. I think, too, that you're probably all aware that there's no such thing as a final order in this whole child custody, child support visitation area. It can always be reopened until the child grows up. So it's always an area, potential area of post-divorce litigation.
Is there any litigation regarding a non-custodial parent's duty to pay a child's college?
There is quite a bit of litigation. And a lot of times people will try to include that in the original decree of divorce. But I've seen several cases in which mothers have gone back in on behalf of their teenage children saying that their father, the decree had said until the age of majority, and go back in and say the father should pay for their college education.
Okay.
Is that your question?
I don't know how to correctly frame it. I think when divorced, generally children are in their minor years. And I don't know if college rises to substantial changes of circumstance, because it seems to me college is a choice. It's not a mandatory need of food, clothing, shelter in terms of circumstances. And that choice seems to go above the original decree. Do girls need to be educated as opposed to boys?
I can see what you're saying, although I have seen cases in which the trial court has said that the decision to go to college or in fact that it wasn't considered in the original decree, and is now actual
change.
Problem in the family is a substantial change in circumstances. I think the courts are usually sympathetic to increases in child support. One thing that comes up in child support modification situations concerns the effects of subsequent marriages on the part of either the payor or the payee parent. If, say, the husband, who's the payor, marries, and his wife works and brings income into his home, her salary can't be counted as part of his actual income when it comes to calculating how much money he has and how much he can afford to pay in child support. But the court can consider that her salary, the money she's bringing in, is diminishing his expenses to some extent. In other words, you see this quite frequently, the husband will have a good job, and the wife will have a good job, the new wife will have a good job, and the husband will, on his financial declaration, claim that he is paying for 100% of the rent payment, 100% of the utilities, and all of the food, and all of the clothing, and all of the insurance, and both car payments, leaving the impression that his wife gets to keep her salary and doesn't have to do anything with it, which in reality is probably not what happened. So the court will sort of look at the effect of her salary on his expenses. If the husband, who is charged with a child support obligation, remarries, and he remarries a woman who has a bunch of kids, and those kids need support, his obligation first remains to his own children. He's just going to have to spread himself thinner if he wants to take care of those other kids. He can't get out of his obligation to support the original children by saying, look, I married this woman and she has four children and her husband's disappeared and they really need me more than the old kids. That won't work. He's acting as a volunteer as far as his new family is concerned. If a wife remarries and her new husband is real wealthy, that does nothing to diminish the husband's, former husband's, obligation to pay child support. And I'm saying a husband is the one that pays and wife is the one that gets, because that is still what happens in most cases. But of course, it could apply the other way around. It's just sort of habit that I put it that way. In any event, the first husband's child support obligation remains exactly the same, even though the wife and husband may be fabulously wealthy. And the only thing that would change it is if new husband adopts the children. Okay, now another real recent case, which is in the child support area, which is a case that Ken did the appeal on, Hedlow versus Hedlow, and that was decided last month also. And it's another somewhat odd case. Four and a half months after the divorce decree was entered, the mother moved to modify to increase her child support, saying that she couldn't make ends meet. And again, this was heard at first before a master and found that there was no showing of substantial material change in circumstances, and who also found that the parties were basically in the same financial positions they'd been in at the time of the divorce. And so he said, no increase, you're out of luck. The wife objected to the master's report, and the Superior Court increased her child support from $400 to $600 a month. So the husband appealed the Superior Court's decision, and saying that the master's findings were not clearly erroneous and that they should be adhered to. And the Supreme Court said, first about the master's report, that it can be disregarded by the Superior Court, that his recommendation, the master's recommendation, is just that, it's a recommendation, but it's not controlling. And they said, with respect to material and substantial change of circumstances, that they found some merit in the husband's argument that there had been no real change in circumstances, but that in child support cases, as in child custody cases, their real concern is with the best interest and the welfare of the children. And that this concern, which is so paramount in child custody cases, can lap over into the area of child support. So then they found that there had been a change of circumstances in that there was a mistaken assumption made when the decree was first entered, and that the real needs of the mother were something different than what had been assumed 7 months earlier. So it seems to me it's saying, because she didn't figure out what she needed at the time of the divorce, she was able to say there was a change of circumstances 7 months later. And the case was remanded, however, because the trial judge didn't make findings of fact. So that's the case that might come up on your exam. It's certainly a recent one. It's certainly going to cause some trouble in the future, I think. It's putting changes of circumstances into a a sort of much more subjective category. Okay, this takes us now to property division, which is a real important area. And I guess this is about page 12 in your outline. Alaska is not a community property state, but our property division laws are similar to those of some community property states, except that we don't have a lot of the very specific rules that a state such as California has. Basically, in Alaska, all property acquired during the marriage will be divided equitably between the parties when they divorce. And more often than not, the divisions of property are 50-50. The longer a marriage has lasted, the more this 50-50 may vary in favor of one of the parties, 60-40, 80-20. Page 12 of your outline has our old property division statute in there, and then the new one, which was changed, and which reads that property is divided between the parties, whether joint or separate, acquired only during coverture, in a manner that may be just, so it doesn't actually say 50-50, and without regard to which of the parties is in fault, so it's the no-fault property division statute. That's something that's very hard for a lot of people to understand. A lot of clients really feel that property should be a vehicle for punishing the one who's been worse in the marriage. And the court, in dividing the property, can invade the property of either spouse acquired before marriage when balancing the equities between the parties if justice requires it. So, basically, as I said, it's a no-fault statute. It doesn't matter who filed for divorce. And marital misdeeds are not going to count one way or the other in a property division. So the court, in a trial where property has to be divided, looks at all of the property acquired during the marriage, regardless of whose name it's in. It doesn't matter if it's all in the husband's name or all in the wife's name. And divides it according to certain criteria, which are known as the marital factors, which I'll discuss in just a second. And if this doesn't bring about an equitable result, the court will then invade property held prior to the marriage or separately acquired during the marriage. So it's a kind of a two-step process. The court won't get into the premarital or the separate property unless there seems to be some reason to do so. And not infrequently, they do find a reason to do so, to invade the premarital property. As your outline says, the statute was basically following the case law, and the leading case in this area is the Merrill case, which sets out the factors the courts to consider, and those are on page 13. They are the respective ages of the parties, their earning ability, the duration and conduct of each during the marriage, their station in life, the circumstances and necessities of each, their health and physical condition, and their financial circumstances, including the time and manner of acquisition of the property in question and its value and its income-producing capacity, if any. Okay, so some of these factors get more attention than others. Conduct doesn't mean who is good and who is bad, who is unfaithful, who drank too much. Conduct means how they lived their lives while they were married. Did the husband work all the time? Did the wife stay home and take care of the house? Did they travel around the world a lot? Did they both work very hard at improving a homestead lot or something like that? So it really is addressing, to a large extent, the party's economic lifestyle during their marriage. station in life means that, to the extent possible, the court will try to keep the parties at the same economic level after divorce as before divorce. This is kind of a joke because you have to have really wealthy people to be able to divorce and pay their attorneys and take vacations to get over the divorce and come back and be in the same economic position they were in when they were still married. I think in practice, I've seen some statistics that most women go rapidly downhill economically after a divorce, and men go down for a little while and then bounce back up. So, nonetheless, the court is supposed to try to keep them in the position they were in before the divorce. Circumstances and necessities of each is pretty self-explanatory. Duration of marriage is real important for property division. In a short-term marriage, property will probably be divided 50-50. And the court probably won't start to look at the premarital property unless there's some really compelling reason. But in a long-term marriage, which I would put it anywhere from 12 to 15 years and on, 20, 30, 40-year marriages, the court often can't sort out the premarital property unless it's separate property that's recently been acquired, and the court is able to find more reasons to invade that property. A fairly recent case, Cook versus Cook, had an interesting discussion of premarital property issue. I think that's in your supplement. The husband brought $40,000 into the marriage, and the marriage lasted for 11 years. The husband didn't work much at all during the marriage. He was not prevented from working by health reasons or anything like that. He just didn't want to work. The wife worked pretty much the whole time through the marriage. And so the court found that her contribution to the marriage had been $50,000 more than the husband. And the court also found that they had an equity in properties worth about $30,000. And the court awarded this $30,000 to the wife. And the Supreme Court said that there was no abuse of discretion in doing this. Obviously, the trial court judge was not at all impressed with Mr. Cook and his contributions to the marriage or his conduct during the marriage. So it's a good example of the court taking conduct into consideration.
Please turn the tape over at this point and continue listening to side 2.